the court knows, this is an action for judicial review under the Teacher Employment Compensation Dismissal Act of the dismissal of a non-probationary teacher, Mr. Lyons. This case is about two legislative changes. The first is the teachers, who are the ones who actually have to do the work, have to be given some latitude when they physically intervene with disruptive students. And because of that latitude, and because the legislature has made a policy determination that it wants schools to be free both from disruptions and also to be safe, teachers are given essentially qualified immunity from being dismissed when they do that. The second legislative mandate, and it's just as important, is that the Colorado legislature has determined that it's not going to allow school districts to just throw away teachers when they make a mistake, that the teachers have to be, by statute, given a notice of their deficiencies, and they have to be given an opportunity to remediate those deficiencies through a formal remediation plan, which, amongst other things, gives them a time limit by which they have to correct those deficiencies and gives them support and resources so they can do so in a formal way, in a written way, and the actual policies for this particular school district remediation plan are in the record. The record also reflects that Mr. Lyons was a very good teacher pursuant to the school district's own evaluations that it did with him over the years. In fact, he never received an unsatisfactory evaluation in the many years he worked for that school district. So our position in this case is that absent some sort of willful conduct on Mr. Lyons' part, or absent some sort of conduct that's not remediable, and the Minnesota case gives an example to the court of somebody who sexually harassed their students, Mr. Lyons, the school district, the legislature has required the school district to provide Mr. Lyons with an opportunity for remediation before it fires him. And the reality,
Counsel, is that a required opportunity for remediation only for neglect of duty, or are you saying that applies also to the other cause?
What the statute says, Your Honor, 2263.301, is it lays out a number of different grounds for dismissal: neglect of duty, insubordination, conviction of a felony, and unsatisfactory performance. Section 3028 of Title 63 of Article 22 says if a teacher is dismissed for unsatisfactory performance, the school district has to comply with the evaluation statute, which is the statute that requires, amongst other things, that the teacher be given a remediation plan. Now, in this case, the district didn't, in its notice of charges, cite unsatisfactory performance as one of the statutory bases for Mr. Lyons' dismissal, but, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. And the reality of the situation is that he was dismissed for unsatisfactory performance, and the administrative law judge found, as a matter of fact, that the matters that he was fired for, having poor classroom organization and neglecting or not, fulfilling the literacy curriculum, were things that could have been dealt with through a remediation plan. Now, the legislature didn't define what unsatisfactory performance is, and the statute could perhaps have been clearer than it was, but it did leave it to the local districts to make that definition. And this particular district did, by its own practice and de jure, at least with the curriculum delivery issue, include the things that they fired Mr. Lyons for in its own definition of what it would cover through the evaluation and the remediation system.
Mr. Kaiser, let me ask you about the statutory requirement to give a teacher an opportunity to remediate under a remediation plan before dismissal. The statute says that if one of the grounds for dismissal is unsatisfactory performance, and so you today and in your briefs have stated that was not one of the grounds for dismissal. So do you have any authority outside of the statute that would require any type of remediation plan?
Well, Your Honor, the school district in its notice of charges didn't say it was unsatisfactory performance, but a basic, as one of the grounds for dismissal, And the statute doesn't, only says, it, the statute says if it's unsatisfactory performance, then it has to be, there has to be the remediation plan. Our position is the facts of the case, it's a question of fact, not with a question of what the school district characterizes it at. Otherwise, they could totally avoid the whole remediation plan system by calling something that, that is in fact unsatisfactory performance as something else. So that's what I'm telling the court.
Right, and so just to follow up with that, do you have any authority that says we look to the facts rather than the ground for dismissal?
Your Honor, as far as I know, this is a case of first impression in Colorado. I don't think there's been a case one way or the other on this issue. I mean, neither party cited one anyway.
Kaiser, if it's a question of fact, was this question of fact presented to the ALJ and did she rule on it?
The legal argument was presented to, I presented it in the written closing argument, and we developed a factual record through, for example, the cross-examination of Mr. Cullum, the old principal who had given Mr. Lyons the one serious letter of warning in 2004, which was 5 years before he was fired. So he made the legal argument. I tried the best I could to develop the facts and argue from those factual development, and the administrative law judge didn't rule on it. I raised it again in the pleading that I filed to the Board of Education, and their decision didn't deal with it either.
Mr. Kaiser, by the way, I appreciate your diplomatically correcting me when I said neglect of duty. I meant unsatisfactory performance. But with respect to the two, is it your position that they totally overlap, neglect of duty and unsatisfactory performance? Are there some forms of conduct that could be, that would fall under both, or is there some conduct, or does all conduct fall under both?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and that's where we're asking this court to give some guidance in the future. I did cite the Minnesota case under a similar, although identical statute, that goes to the issue of whether the conduct's remediable. That was the one where the counselor sexually harassed the students. Is there something that you could do to remediate this person? Is you look at the potential for harm to management and things of that nature. I mean, to answer your question, I would say yes, there are things that would constitute neglect of duty which wouldn't require a remediation plan. For example, if somebody just continually shows up late to work, right, they're neglecting their duty by not showing up to work, typically that would be dealt with through a corrective action plan because you can't, you know, I guess you can tell somebody to buy an alarm clock, but that's not really a remedial matter. Whereas somebody who's not teaching the curriculum, that's something that you can give somebody help for. And in fact, they did give Mr. Lyons some help in an informal way, but not through a remediation plan. And that, you know, I mean, one of the other realities of this case, factually, is they weren't even, as far as the record reveals, even seriously thinking about firing him. The only thing the principal, Ms. Blomeyer, said was, we're thinking about, I was considering a letter of warning for the things that resulted in dismissal, which isn't even the most serious step under their corrective action policy. Then they got this allegation that Mr. Lyons assaulted this student, DT, and that's when they moved forward for dismissal, and that allegation wasn't proven.
So it's your position that the conduct we're talking about could fall under both, and when it falls under both, then it has to be treated as unsatisfactory performance for purposes of a remediation
That's
program?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. Given the statutory construction and the language that says when there's an allegation of unsatisfactory performance, you have to go through the remediation process, shouldn't we conclude that none of the other grounds for dismissal require that?
I can't remember the exact language, Your Honor. I'll check it for purposes of my rebuttal argument. I thought what it said, and I could be wrong on this, is it says when a teacher is fired for unsatisfactory performance. I don't think it says when the district alleges, but I would submit that that would be a distinction without a difference if the court wants to give the remediation plan requirement any substantive meaning.
Ask you, your opposing counsel has raised a contention that your failure to appeal the determination of the ALJ that Mr. Lyons did not comply with the curriculum means that we must affirm on that basis. What's your response to that?
Well, my response to that, Your Honor, is, you know, if they have to remediate him first, even if, I mean, anytime somebody engages in unsatisfactory performance and anytime somebody's put on a special evaluation, which is the first step, you do an off cycle, well, an unsatisfactory evaluation, whether it's off cycle every 3 years, before every 3 years or not, They have to do that first. That's a precondition to put them on a remediation plan. If every time somebody did something wrong that resulted in unsatisfactory evaluation, then you didn't have to remediate them, then again, that would render the statutory requirement meaningless. I lost where I was with my prepared argument, but that's good because I prefer questions. You know, the other thing I point out to the court, as a matter of fact, and this goes to the first argument that I raised in the brief, everything else they fired him for, they were very well aware of it. They knew he was physically intervening with DT. They knew he had issues with his curriculum development, although delivery and his organization, although never raised to the point where they even mentioned it in one of the summative evaluations. You know, and to the extent that the statute isn't as clear as it should be, which it's not. I mean, what happened was when the legislature revised TECTA, they sent it to a committee, the committee came up with something, and that's how it ended up in the statute. So, but the rule of lenity would favor construction in favor of Mr. Lyons as the person who's suffering the result of governmental action. Finally, just going to the...
But before you move from that, rule of lenity is a rule...
By analogy, Your Honor, only. I would also point out that the DPS old policy, the one that came up to this court in Frederickson 25 years ago, did allow for physical intervention to quell a disruption, and that's certainly much closer to a contemporaneous administrative construction to when the statute was first enacted in 1983 than the policy that they subsequently changed. I would like to save at least a little bit of time for rebuttal, unless the court, but of course, if the court has questions now. If not, I'd like to save my 3 minutes for plus for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Martin Semple. I represent the Denver Public Schools. And I think what's critical in this particular appeal is that what's not challenged by the appellant. And there's evidentiary facts that the hearing officer found that aren't challenged, which is that Lyons failed to strictly implement the district's literacy curriculum, that he admitted that he didn't follow the Readers and Writers Workshop, which is part of the literacy curriculum, didn't implement it in his lesson plans, that he didn't review the special education students, DT's, IEP, individual education plan. He admitted he violated the school district's physical intervention plan, or policy, I should say, and that's none of the actions that he took fell within the grounds for physical intervention in that policy. All of those constitute neglect of duty under the case law. On the grounds of other than good and just cause, doesn't even challenge it. He says that Lyons was, the classroom was cluttered, unorganized, and in fact the he was discussed numerous times with the principals regarding that it was an unsafe environment, and that the clutter in fact caused an environment that was not conducive to learning. All of those are unchallenged evidentiary facts, and all of them constitute one, neglect of duty, and two, other good and just cause. And what's important here is what is not appealed as opposed to what is appealed. And the statement that he made, and I think Mr. Kaiser is admitting it in the reply brief, it says, Lyons' position is not dependent on reversal of the ALJ and the board's findings with respect to instructional delivery or classroom organization. He's not challenging that. And the case law is clear as can be that if there is, in fact, any single grounds that's stated in the statute, that the superintendent listed as a grounds for termination in his recommendation, and the superintendent didn't specify neglect of duty, another good and just cause, that if those are present, and if they're not challenged, then that alone is grounds to reject the appeal. And we cited the Cornish case where the Supreme Court dealt with precisely that same issue. It was a Denver Public Schools case again, where the teacher was found to have neglected her duty because she failed to implement the math curriculum. Now, she has reasons from her point of view why she didn't do it, but the Supreme Court said the failure to challenge that ultimate finding by the Board of Education is in and of itself grounds to terminate and to uphold the termination. And that's precisely the case here.
Excuse me, Mr. Semple. The conduct you enumerated at the beginning, you said fell under both neglect of duty and other just cause, I think. Do they also fall under unsatisfactory performance? Or could they? I realize they weren't designated as that by them.
They could, Your Honor. But I think in response to a question that you asked of Mr. Kaiser, and I pulled the section 302, subsection 8 of the statute, and what it says is the chief administrative officer shall have the burden of proving that the recommendation for dismissal of the teacher was for the reasons given in the notice of appeal, or notice of dismissal, and the dismissal was in accordance with the provisions of the statute. Now, the second sentence, which is the critical one that he's trying to rely on, says this: when unsatisfactory performance is a ground for dismissal, that's the language of the statute, then you have to comply with the Evaluation Act, which does have some remediation provisions in there.
So does that mean that the board has the ability to just change the labels to avoid having to provide the remediation?
It's not a question of changing labels, Your Honor. It's a question of meeting the statutory definition and the case law interpretation of what is neglect of duty and what is other good and just cause. And in all of those, there would be overlap. Insubordination is the same way. Someone could be insubordinate because they are, in fact, an unsatisfactory performer. That's a possibility. But there's the language of the statute is clear as can be. If a stated grounds for dismissal is unsatisfactory performance, then there's certain things you have to do. The stated ground here is not unsatisfactory performance. Never was, isn't an issue in this case.
So
the arguments that he see, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I was going to say that doesn't that then give the school district the incentive to simply never talk about unsatisfactory performance, because then they'll have to do a remediation plan, and isn't that counterproductive to helping teachers improve their performance?
If it's strictly unsatisfactory performance, and that's all that's there, and it doesn't constitute neglect of duty or it doesn't constitute other good and just cause, then they'd have to go with unsatisfactory performance. But otherwise, you're disregarding what are separate grounds and what the Supreme Court in its body of case law has indicated, that if any single separate ground for dismissal is found to be present in based on the evidentiary facts, then the Board of Education has the discretion, that's the board's discretion, to terminate that teacher. And that's precisely the case here. And it's a red herring, really, to say, well, this guy was an unsatisfactory performer. That's what they're saying. And saying, because he was an unsatisfactory performer, you cannot terminate him for neglect of duty. You cannot terminate him for other good and just cause. And that is not the law. That's not what the statute says. It's not the grounds that are specified in the statute, and it's not what the case law says, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The other aspects of the argument that are the other, and I think the critical aspect there, again, is the Cornish case, because Cornish was decided long after unsatisfactory performance was listed as a grounds for dismissal. That came in 1990, I think it was. And there again, the Supreme Court never considered that in some way this teacher was entitled to some kind of a remediation plan, which was simply not required. Because if that's what they wanted, if that's what the legislatures had intended, then they would have said that. And that's not what they said. They said if a grounds for dismissal is unsatisfactory performance, then you have to do certain other things. Obviously, that's saying if it grounds for dismissal is not unsatisfactory performance, then that's not a requirement. And I think that's the critical aspect or the critical distinction that we're dealing with here. As far as the other basic arguments that he's making, the other seems to be that the requirement is that if what triggered the action of the Board of Education or the superintendent isn't actually proved, then all of the other grounds or all of the other facts regarding this teacher can be disregarded and you can't terminate him. And again, he admitted there's no case law in Colorado to support that proposition. In fact, he tries to hang his hat on the Flanning case, and Flanning doesn't stand for that proposition. In fact, Flanning stands clearly for the proposition, supported by the Supreme Court in its findings, that in fact, prior incidents can be evidentiary facts that are critical in determining whether a teacher should be dismissed or not. The situation here is that this individual was put on administrative leave to investigate a certain complaint that was made against him. In association with that, his full record was reviewed. And the bottom line on it was that for a whole series of reasons and a whole series of activities that he had engaged in or not engaged in that he should have, he was specified that in fact there were grounds for dismissal. And the idea that, again, that you can't rely on the track record of the teacher just because one thing triggered him being placed on leave, that's not what triggered his being terminated. What triggered his being terminated was a review of his performance, of his record, of what he did and didn't do, and based on that, the superintendent recommended his dismissal for neglect of duty, and he recommended his dismissal for other good and just cause. As far as the violation of the physical intervention policy goes, that policy is quite consistent with the language of the Act. And there's nothing in any way that indicates that that policy is in some way illegal on its face. And the fact of the matter is that he admitted himself that he, in fact, violated that policy, that the grounds for physical intervention in question just weren't present when he, and again, he admitted doing this, he admitted that he tugged and jerked this special education youngster when he was asleep at his desk to yank him up. And that's simply not in line with the physical intervention policy. The other critical element, which is totally overlooked and which clearly constitutes neglect of duty, is that a teacher who doesn't even review, who never reads the individual education program that is required under the federal law for a special education student like this, that alone constitutes neglect of duty. And that's a good example, I think, Your Honor, of saying where's the line, if there is a line between certain aspects of neglect of duty and unsatisfactory performance. That might not in and of itself be unsatisfactory performance, but it's certainly neglect of duty. And again,
saying that violates a federal law?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. You said that violated a federal law?
Yeah, the violation of under federal law, and we referenced it under IDEA, the federal law dealing with special education students, every such student has to have an individual education program, and the district, the school, and the teacher are required to follow that individual education program. That's a mandate of the federal statute. And the idea that someone would admit, or in fact, would not have read that particular program for a youngster that is in his classroom is essentially unconscionable. And that's why the bottom line in this case is, what were the grounds that were found by the administrative law judge? Did, in fact, the statute that I read for you is that the burden of proof on the superintendent is to prove to the ALJ that the reasons for termination that are specified in the letter of recommendation have been proved. And there is absolutely no question in this case that they were proved. And in fact, they've been admitted by the teacher because it's not challenging the evidentiary facts on which neglect of duty and other good and just cause were found is in accordance with the Cornish case without question grounds to dismiss the appeal and uphold the termination. Unless you've got questions, I've concluded. Thank you.
Just a few points on rebuttal. First of all, Cornish didn't deal with whether or not the teacher needed to be put on a remediation plan. So Cornish is an apposite. I mean, I don't want to quibble, but it's also a decision of this court, not the Supreme Court. And Cornish was a precipitating incident for which she was fired, unlike this case. So Cornish doesn't control this case. Flaming, the whole Supreme, there were, you know, three prior incidents of inappropriate use of force by the teacher in Flaming. The Supreme Court spent its whole opinion on whether the precipitating incident, the board's finding of ultimate fact, and as to the precipitating incident, was justified in reversing, well, the board was justified in reversing the hearing officer in that case, or the panel, whichever it was at the time.
Mr. Kaiser, I'm sorry. In Flaming, did it discuss that it needed to discuss the precipitating incident, otherwise you could not dismiss the teacher?
Flaming does not say that, Your Honor.
Okay.
But that's what it spent its time on. That's what the opinion spent its time on, was the precipitating incident.
My understanding in Flaming is there was a concern whether the board was making additional findings from the record that the hearing officer had not made, which happened to be as to the last incident, and that was the focus of that case. So could you draw our attention in Flaming to where it stands for the proposition you're urging, that you need to have the precipitating incident?
Your Honor, I think there were two issues in Flaming. One was the findings beyond those made by the fact finder. The other was the board reversed the fact finder's finding of ultimate fact that the teacher's physical intervention and the precipitating incident was inappropriate. It never raised the last straw incident, so Flaming's not controlling one way or the other. But I would think that the court wouldn't have spent all that time on the precipitating incident if the prior three incidents were enough to justify dismissal. That's what I'm saying. Also, just going back and double-checking 3028, what the statute says is if unsatisfactory performance is a ground for dismissal, then the school district has to comply with the evaluation statute and the remediation provisions thereof. It doesn't say if it's a ground alleged, so I would argue that the legislative language focuses on what the facts are, not what the superintendent claims, again, because otherwise they could avoid the statute. Finally, as to the IEP, that's a red herring. First of all, failure to read the IEP wasn't alleged as a grounds for dismissal. Second, there was nothing in the IEP that would have helped Mr. Lyons deal with this student's particular behaviors. The place where those behaviors should have been dealt with was in the in a behavior plan, which is a supplement to the IEP, and there was no behavior plan. In addition, certainly the undisputed testimony of the expert is the practice in the field where the student is this disruptive and had assaulted, in our case, his first grade teacher threw a chair at her, is that the special education teacher is responsible, as a much smaller caseload than the general education teacher with 30 other students, for helping the general education teacher, you know, deal with what was an extremely disruptive environment for this teacher when he had multiple other students to educate, which is the reality of this case, and which is why I would respectfully submit to this court why teachers are in this unique position and given this unique statutory protection that we've discussed in this case. Thank you for your attention.
This will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.